Chapter 20. Of this Madonna della Pieta, T is ghetto zone. I said, with all the enthusiasm of my nature, for I had been poring intently over its surpassing loveliness. I it is ghetto zone. How could you have obtained it? Question mark. She is undoubtedly in painting, what the Venus is in sculpture. A. Said he thoughtfully, the Venus, the beautiful Venus, the Venus of the Medici, she of the diminutive head and the gilded hair, part of the left arm. Here his voice dropped so as to be heard with difficulty, and all the right are restorations, and in the coquetry of that right arm lies, I think, the quintessence of all affectation. Give me the Canova. The Apollo too is a copy. There can be no doubt of it. Blind fool that I am, who cannot behold the boasted inspiration of the Apollo. I cannot help pity me. I cannot help preferring the Antinous. Was it not Socrates who said that the statuary found his statue in the block of marble? Then Michelangelo was by no means original in his couplet, non alitimo artista alcan concedo ci un marmo solo in si non circunscriva. ... It has been, or should be remarked, that, in the manner of the true gentleman, we are always aware of a difference from the bearing of the vulgar, without being at once precisely able to determine in what such difference consists. Allowing the remark to have applied in its full force to the outward demeanor of my acquaintance, I felt it, on that eventful morning, still more fully applicable to his moral temperament and character. Nor can I better define that peculiarity of spirit which seemed to place him so essentially apart from all other human beings, than by calling it a habit of intense and continual thought, pervading even his most trivial actions, intruding upon his moments of dalliance and interweaving itself with his very flashes of merriment like adders which writhe from out the eyes of the grinning masks in the cornices around the temples of Persepolis. I could not help, however, repeatedly observing, through the mingled tone of levity and solemnity with which he rapidly descanted upon matters of little importance, a certain air of trepidation, a degree of nervous unction in action and in speech, an unquiet excitability of manner which appeared to me at all times unaccountable, and upon some occasions even filled me with alarm. Frequently too, pausing in the middle of a sentence whose commencement he had apparently forgotten, he seemed to be listening in the deepest attention, as if either in momentary expectation of a visitor, or to sounds which must have had existence in his imagination alone. It was during one of these reveries or pauses of apparent abstraction, that, in turning over a page of the poet and scholar Politian's beautiful tragedy, Orfeo, the first native Italian tragedy, which lay near me upon an ottoman, I discovered a passage underlined in pencil. It was a passage towards the end of the third act, a passage of the most heart-stirring excitement, a passage which, although tainted with impurity, no man shall read without a thrill of novel emotion, no woman without a sigh. The whole page was blotted with fresh tears, and, upon the opposite interleaf, were the following English lines, written in a hand so very different from the peculiar characters of my acquaintance, that I had some difficulty in recognizing it as his own: Thou wast that all to me, love, for which my soul did pine, a green isle in the sea, love, a fountain and a shrine, all wreathed with fairy fruits and flowers, and all the flowers were mine. Ah, dream too bright to last. Ah, starry hope, that didst arise, but to be overcast. A voice from out the future cries, Nward. But o'er the past, dim gulf. My spirit hovering lies, mute, motionless, aghast. For alas, alas, with me the light of life is o'er. Oh, more, no more, no more, such language holds the solemn seed of the sands upon the shore. Shall bloom the thunder-blasted tree, or the stricken eagle soar. Now all my hours are trances, and all my nightly dreams are where the dark eye glances, and where thy footstep gleams, in what ethereal dances, by what Italian streams. Alas! For that accursed time they bore thee o'er the billow, from love to titled age and crime, and an unholy pillow. From me, and from our misty clime, where weeps the silver willow. that these lines were written in English, a language with which I had not believed their author acquainted, afforded me little matter for surprise. I was too well aware of the extent of his acquirements, and of the singular pleasure he took in concealing them from observation, to be astonished at any similar discovery. But the place of date, I must confess, occasioned me no little amazement. It had been originally written London, and afterwards carefully overscored, not, however, so effectually as to conceal the word from a scrutinizing eye. I say, this occasioned me no little amazement, for I well remember that, in a former conversation with a friend, I particularly inquired if he had at any time met in London the Marchesa di Montoni, who for some years previous to her marriage had resided in that city. When his answer, if I mistake not, gave me to understand that he had never visited the metropolis of Great Britain. I might as well here mention that I have more than once heard, without, of course, giving credit to a report involving so many improbabilities, that the person of whom I speak was not only by birth, but in education, an Englishman. *** Here is one painting, said he, without being aware of my notice of the tragedy. Here is still one painting which you have not seen. And throwing aside a drapery, he discovered a full-length portrait of the Marchesa Aphrodite. Human art could have done no more in the delineation of her superhuman beauty. The same ethereal figure which stood before me the preceding night upon the steps of the Ducal Palace, stood before me once again. But in the expression of the countenance, which was beaming all over with smiles, there still lurked incomprehensible anomaly. That fitful stain of melancholy which will ever be found inseparable from the perfection of the beautiful. Her right arm lay folded over her bosom. With her left she pointed downward to a curiously fashioned vase. One small, fairy foot, alone visible, barely touched the earth, and, scarcely discernible in the brilliant atmosphere which seemed to encircle and enshrine her loveliness, floated a pair of the most delicately imagined wings. My glance fell from the painting to the figure of my friend, and the vigorous words of Chapman's bussy damn voice quivered instinctively upon my lips: he is up there like a Roman statue. He will stand till death hath made him marble, he said at length, turning towards a table of richly enameled and massive silver, upon which were a few goblets fantastically stained, together with two large Etruscan vases, fashioned in the same extraordinary model as that in the foreground of the portrait, and filled with what I supposed to be Johannisberger. He said, abruptly, let us drink. It is early, but let us drink. It is indeed early, he continued, musingly, as a cherub with a heavy golden hammer made the apartment ring with the first hour after sunrise, he is indeed early, but what matters it, let us drink. Let us pour out an offering to yon solemn sun which these gaudy lamps and censers are so eager to subdue, and, having made me pledge him in a bumper, he swallowed in rapid succession several goblets of the wine. Dream, he continued, resuming the tone of his desultory conversation, as he held up to the rich light of a censer one of the magnificent vases, dream has been the business of my life. I have therefore framed for myself, as you see, a bower of dreams. In the heart of Venice could I have erected a better? You behold around you, it is true, a medley of architectural embellishments. The chastity of Ionia is offended by antediluvian devices, and the sphinxes of Egypt are outstretched upon carpets of gold. Yet the effect is incongruous to the timid alone. Proprieties of place, and especially of time, are the bugbears which terrify mankind from the contemplation of the magnificent. Once I was myself a decorist, but that sublimation of folly has palled upon my soul. All this is now the fitter for my purpose. Like these arabesque censers, my spirit is writhing in fire, and the delirium of this scene is fashioning me for the wilder visions of that land of real dreams, whither I am now rapidly departing. He here paused abruptly, bent his head to his bosom, and seemed to listen to a sound which I could not hear. At length, erecting his frame, he looked upwards, and ejaculated the lines of the Bishop of Chichester: colon, tay for me there. I will not fail to meet thee in that hollow vale. In the next instant, confessing the power of the wine, he threw himself at full length upon an ottoman. A quick step was now heard upon the staircase, and a loud knock at the door rapidly succeeded. I was hastening to anticipate a second disturbance, when a page of Montoni's household burst into the room, and faltered out, in a voice choking with emotion, the incoherent words, "My mistress! My mistress!" Poisoned exclamation point, poisoned exclamation point, oh, beautiful Aphrodite. Bewildered, I flew to the ottoman, and endeavored to arouse the sleeper to a sense of the startling intelligence. But his limbs were rigid, his lips were livid, his lately beaming eyes were riveted in death. I staggered back towards the table, my hand fell upon a cracked and blackened goblet, and a consciousness of the entire and terrible truth flashed suddenly over my soul. Tilde, 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 end of text, tilde, 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 equals, 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 the pit, and the pendulum, impia tortorum longos hic turba fuers sanguinis innocuit, non sediata, eluit. Suspite nunc patria, fracto nunc funeris antro, mors abi dira fuit vita salisc patent. Quatrain composed for the gates of a market to be erected upon the site of the Jacobin clubhouse at Paris. I was sick, sick unto death with that long agony, and when they at length unbound me, and I was permitted to sit, I felt that my senses were leaving me. The sentence, the dread sentence of death, was the last of distinct accentuation which reached my ears. After that, the sound of the inquisitorial voices seemed merged in one dreamy indeterminate hum. It conveyed to my soul the idea of revolution, perhaps from its association in fancy with the burr of a mill wheel. This only for a brief period, for presently I heard no more. Yet, for a while, I saw, but with how terrible an exaggeration. I saw the lips of the black-robed judges. They appeared to me white, whiter than the sheet upon which I trace these words, and thin even to grotesqueness. Thin with the intensity of their expression, of firmness, of immovable resolution, of stern contempt of human torture. I saw that the decrees of what to me was fate were still issuing from those lips. I saw them writhe with a deadly locution. I saw them fashion the syllables of my name, and I shuddered, because no sound succeeded. I saw too, for a few moments of delirious horror, the soft and nearly imperceptible waving of the sable draperies which enwrapped the walls of the apartment. And then my vision fell upon the seven tall candles upon the table. At first they wore the aspect of charity, and seemed white and slender angels who would save me. But then, all at once, there came a most deadly nausea over my spirit, and I felt every fiber in my frame thrill, as if I had touched the wire of a galvanic battery, while the angel forms became meaningless specters, with heads of flame, and I saw that from them there would be no help. And then there stole into my fancy, like a rich musical note, the thought of what sweet rest there must be in the grave. The thought came gently and stealthily, and it seemed long before it attained full appreciation. But just as my spirit came at length properly to feel and entertain it, the figures of the judges vanished, as if magically, from before me. The tall candles sank into nothingness. Their flames went out utterly. The blackness of darkness supervened. All sensations appeared swallowed up in a mad rushing descent, as of the soul into Hades. Then silence, and stillness, night were the universe. I had swooned, but still will not say that all of consciousness was lost. What of it there remained I will not attempt to define, or even to describe. Yet all was not lost. In the deepest slumber, no. In delirium, no. In a swoon, no. In death, no. Even in the grave all is not lost. Else there is no immortality for man. Arousing from the most profound of slumbers, we break the gossamer web of some dream. Yet in a second afterward, So frail may that web have been, we remember, not that we have dreamed. In the return to life from the swoon there are two stages. First, that of the sense of mental or spiritual. Secondly, that of the sense of physical existence. It seems probable that if, upon reaching the second stage, we could recall the impressions of the first, we should find these impressions eloquent in memories of the gulf beyond. And that gulf is what? How at least shall we distinguish its shadows from those of the tomb? But if the impressions of what I have termed the first stage are not, at will, recalled, yet, after long interval, do they not come unbidden, while we marvel whence they come? He who has never swooned is not he who finds strange palaces and wildly familiar faces in coals that glow, is not he who beholds floating in mid-air the sad visions that the many may not view. Is not he who ponders over the perfume of some novel flower, is not he whose brain grows bewildered with the meaning of some musical cadence which has never before arrested his attention. Amid frequent and thoughtful endeavors to remember, amid earnest struggles to regather some token of the state of seeming nothingness into which my soul had lapsed, there have been moments when I have dreamed of success. There have been brief, very brief periods when I have conjured up remembrances which the lucid reason of a later epoch assures me could have had reference only to that condition of seeming unconsciousness. These shadows of memory tell, indistinctly, of tall figures that lifted and bore me in silence down, down, still down till a hideous dizziness oppressed me at the mere idea of the interminableness of the descent. They tell also of a vague horror at my heart, on account of that heart's unnatural stillness. Then comes a sense of sudden motionlessness throughout all things, as if those who bore me a ghastly train had outrun, in their descent, the limits of the limitless, and paused from the wearisomeness of their toil. After this I call to mind flatness and dampness. And then all is madness, the madness of a memory which busies itself among forbidden things. Very suddenly there came back to my soul motion, and sound the tumultuous motion of the heart, and, in my ears, the sound of its beating. Then a pause in which all is blank. Then again sound, and motion, and touch, a tingling sensation pervading my frame. Then the mere consciousness of existence, without thought, a condition which lasted long. Then, very suddenly, thought, and shuddering terror, and earnest endeavor to comprehend my true state. Then a strong desire to lapse into insensibility. Then a rushing revival of soul, and a successful effort to move. And now a full memory of the trial, of the judges, of the sable draperies, of the sentence, of the sickness, of the swoon. Then entire forgetfulness of all that followed, of all that a later day, and much earnestness of endeavor have enabled me vaguely to recall. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.